Look at that. Look at that harmonica man.
You're trying to be Bob Dylan?
Okay, who's going to take the lyrics?
Somebody once told me it's good. I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed. She was looking kind of dumb with her finger in her thumb in the shape of her nail on her forehead.
Any new listeners we have are now gone.
Guys, podcast change. It's all sung now.
It's like Les Mis.
Welcome, Secret Movie Clubbers, to Secret Movie Club Podcast 23. We are in the middle of August, and today our theme is going to be great movies that take place in Los Angeles. So Los Angeles themed movies, but we'll also just talk about any movie that has a great sense of location, but mostly great Los Angeles movies, specifically The Big Lebowski, the Coen brothers' Big Lebowski, and Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love, because we showed them last week at our sold out again, knock wood. I hope you guys keep coming. Parking Lot Cinema in Glendale. So thank you everybody for coming out. That was awesome to have it totally sold out. We were enjoying three, it looked like teenage boys. Daniel, you, Casey, and I, because we were all on bathroom duty, there were these three teenage boys who were sitting in like the flatbed of a pickup truck, because that's still COVID safe because they're technically inside the car. They had the masks, but we saw them from behind silhouetted by the screen. And when we were watching Fast Times at Ridgemont High, every time there was a sex moment, these guys like looked at each other and punched each other in the shoulder like it was the greatest thing they had ever seen. And I felt like I was 15 again. And so when the Phoebe Cates part came, we were all of punching each other in the shoulder, and we're 30-year-olds, and they were punching themselves in the shoulder. It was like a weird time loop. But anyway, we did all those movies. Who's on the podcast with us today?
Hello, it's Daniel Lon. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's Los Angeles' own Connor Lloyd Cruz.
It's me, back at it again, you know, doing my own thing, our survival, you know.
Yeah. Filmmaker, writer, director, cameraman, life philosopher, - Edwin Gomez. Edwin, your hair has officially passed the awesome. That hair is now officially awesome.
I'm going to keep growing it long, man, because that's how I had my hair. I had it super long, so I'm letting it grow,
my name's
man.
Craig. I'm the founder programmer of Secret Movie Club. Just a quick announcement. Hi, I did it again. Announcements. This Friday, our next week of Parking Lot Cinema at the Sears Glendale parking lot, which strangely is working out quite well. On Friday, August 21st, we're going to do a zombie summer double feature. At 8:10 p.m., we're going to do Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead. At 10:40 p.m., we are going to do Zack Snyder's remake, which should not have worked and worked amazingly.
Written by James Gunn.
And we got to talk about that too. Yeah, written by Guardians of the Galaxy and Super Zone and Trauma Zone, James Gunn. Maybe that's why it works so well. It's a great script, among other things. But that's our double feature. And then we have been wanting to do this. We finally got Disney to give us the okay, which took forever. But anyway, we cleared Disney. So we are going to start a Family Feature Sundays, or Sunday Family Days. What do I call them? Family Sundays. It wasn't that wordy. Family Sundays. And we're going to screen the movie that started it all, Pixar's Toy Story 1, the very first Pixar movie. But after that, we're going to do titles of all kinds. And there you go. And if you have any comments for us, please write us at community@secretmovieclub.com or podcast@secretmovieclub.com. We are going to be doing these drive-ins until we get the all clear to go back to the theaters. But we are this Wednesday recording our Secret Movie Club Radio Hour Episode 3, written and directed by Daniel Ott. I am actively preparing, I don't want to talk about it too much, but a way for us to do virtual screenings, which we're going to do time to time, that will be native to Secret Movie Club. So the projects continue. Hopefully the growing continues. And that's what is on the buffet that we call Secret Movie Club for the upcoming few weeks. Main topic. Great. Los Angeles movies. I'm a Los Angeles native. I was born in Granada Hills in 1977.
Good year.
And after my folks split, I spent weekends here, the weeks in Orange County, and then I went to college in L.A. I went to USC. And so since I was 18, I've just been in L.A. full-time, mostly on the East Side. So I have a lot of love for East Side movies. And if you're not from Los Angeles, when we say the East Side, that roughly means Hollywood East. So that's Hollywood, downtown, Silver Lake, Echo Park, Pasadena, East L.A., City of Industry, all the Downey, that's all East L.A.
Yeah, East L.A. is where most of our screenings have always been.
Yeah, we've been East Side for life.
That's our territory, man.
Yeah, Edwin, you're also a Los Angelino.
I am. Hardcore, man.
West L.A., the demarcating line for West L.A. is usually Beverly Hills and West Hollywood. Oof. So La Cienega, for anybody who wants to know streets, La Cienega and Sunset is usually the demarcator. And once you cross over La Cienega, you're kind of in West L.A., and by the time you get over the 405, you are for sure in West L.A. And actually, lest you think you understand, Quentin Tarantino is West L.A. So Quentin Tarantino is South Bay. That's West L.A., Santa Monica, Venice Beach.
I feel like West L.A. is the L.A. that you see more in movies. It's kind of like West Texas versus East Texas as well.
Totally. And then Paul Thomas Anderson, weirdly, has staked out the valley, the San Fernando Valley, which is where I was born and where he was born. And that's almost like its own thing. It's kind of like the Brooklyn. That's not really right. Maybe it's the Bronx. Maybe it's Long Island. Maybe it's Staten Island. But the San Fernando Valley, if you're somebody who knows New York better, people sort of look down a little bit on the San Fernando Valley. So if you're from the Valley, you have a weird ambivalence that you deal with. The first movie we showed was the Coen Brothers' Big Lebowski, which oddly for New Yorkers, because the Coens are Minnesotans, so actually, strike that. They live in New York now, but they grew up in Minnesota. They're Midwesterners. They nailed L.A., and they did it with love and affection, which is not something that happens often. If Woody Allen references L.A., it's often in a derogatory way. A lot of New York filmmakers don't even make movies in L.A., and if they do, like Connor was just saying, it seems to be about Hollywood or how everyone's on cocaine or like it has nothing to do with the real L.A., by the way. The real L.A. is filled with, we have the biggest Armenian community, the biggest Salvadorian community. We're like one of the most multicultural cities in the entire world. I'm not going to go off. This isn't an L.A. PSA, but nevertheless, the L.A. you see in movies is not the L.A. that actually exists. Anyway, let's jump into Big Lebowski. Most people know it. It is the Coen Brothers' 1998 riff on Raymond Chandler novels, starring Jeff Bridges as the dude and his best friend, John Goodman, Walter Sobchak, as a Vietnam vet who get involved in a kidnapping and basically are the least equipped to deal with the mystery. But it is also an incredible Valentine to Los Angeles.
Another one, we've talked about it many times, another one of those movies that you see as a teen and it's like there's a segment of your life where it's one of your friend's favorite movies. And when I saw it under that scope with a friend, I didn't get it. I was like, this is fine. It's not that funny. But then every time you come back to it, somehow it draws you back in. Someone else hits that part where like Big Lebowski is my favorite movie. And you're like, okay, I'll watch it again. Second time you watch it, you're like, okay, I kind of get it. And every time it sucks you back in for a new little detail. And I don't really understand how it works. It is like this singular, weird entity of a movie that every time you revisit it, the older you get, it becomes more and more and more beautiful. And you find something new to love. And I think this is my first time watching it now living in L.A. And having spent a good amount of time bowling with friends, and I get it now.
Big Lebowski is like a Greek myth of sort of a horn of plenty that refills itself. I've seen it 30 times, I think. No joke, no exaggeration. And every time I see it, I still get something new out of it. I don't know how that works. I don't know any other movie that's quite like that.
I hadn't seen this in a while. And to be fair, outside of the film, I was kind of worried because I think it has sort of been like a slow burn Napoleon Dynamite in the sense that so many people quote this movie, and I would say it's almost overquoted to a certain degree. There's this like cult around it that I'm totally cool with it, but I think for me, I worry that, you know, are people just watching this because it's a guy hanging out, you know, and I feel like there's kind of more to it, and then every time I come to it, there is more to it, and I think that that backbone of it being essentially like a Raymond Chandler parody is really strong and really, really interesting. The more every time I watched this time specifically, I noticed just how much the dude echoes things that other people say.
Yeah.
And he's still like, he still has a good heart, I would say, overall, but he's kind of full of crap through most of this movie. He is. I think the thing about L.A., the Coen brothers feel like, maybe more so than any other American filmmakers, like regional historians or
that's
something.
That's really, that's like the key. That's such a great point. Yeah.
Every Coen brothers movie is so not just intrinsically American, but intrinsically about one part of America. And they're so good at it. And I think they nail it pretty much every time. And admittedly, I've only lived in LA and in Texas, but their movies about those places feel very genuine. You know, I've been to New York, I've been to a lot of other places, and those movies also always feel genuine to me as well.
It feels like they care, and I think that's so important, because I think a lot of, as we were talking about in describing LA, there's this really easy way that a writer or a director can take when they approach a city or something that they don't really know the community or the area in.
And it feels like they love all these areas too.
Yeah, they seem to genuinely do. And I think we, like, I mean, we're being, I'm from Oklahoma, you're from Texas, we are, our states are often represented in ways that are portrayed as humorous or sort of like, which is unfair because of what the states can offer. And so to have filmmakers like that that do seem to care that it needs to feel right by the characters as much as the direction and the setting, yeah, I think is lovely and part of their charm.
I almost did a Texas versus Oklahoma thing, and I was like, what representations?
I think you guys just hit on gold, because the Coens don't clown any location they do. They take it seriously. And I didn't even put together that, of course, they would do the same for L.A. Why would they treat L.A. any differently than they've treated Minnesota or North Dakota or Texas or Arizona? Or, but of course, they'd treat Los Angeles from almost an anthropological point of view. And I think that that's what I love about it, is they're taking L.A. seriously enough that they figured out things about L.A. that no one ever puts in the movie. I was telling someone, I love the little detail that when they go to In-N-Out Burger, they mention the street it's on. So they're like, what In-N-Out Burger are you going to? They're like, the In-N-Out Burger on this street. And you're like, that's a very L.A. thing. You're like, oh, what In-N-Out did you go to? I don't know why we do that, but we do that. So I love that. Edwin, what do you think of Lebowski?
Oh, it's like one of the greatest movies ever made, just in general. Connor mentioned about being like a cult thing. I actually been to one. They call it Lebowski Fest. I went to it like 2 years ago, I think. It was probably the greatest event I've ever went to in my life. Seeing everyone dressed up as their favorite characters from the movie, it's like the most funnest time I ever have, seeing people worship this movie, because it's so chill, it's so great. It's Jeff Bridges at his finest. And as for John Goodman and Steve Buscemi, who keeps telling him to shut the up, Donnie, which I don't know if anyone knows it, but the Coens wanted that specifically, because he talked too much in Fargo, so that's why they kept telling him to shut up, which I found out recently. And another thing, Ben Gazzara, what a run he had in the 90s, man. I barely noticed that when I saw the movie.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, Happiness.
Buffalo 66? Yeah, Buffalo 66.
Yeah, Buffalo 66.
He had a good run in the 90s, man, being like in three great movies. Damn. Way to go, Ben. And of course, it is a great L.A. movie. I love it. I actually went to the diner where they shot the coffee scene.
Oh, yeah. You see it right there on Fairfax and Wilshire. Well, and Edwin, as a native Los Angelino, how do you feel about Lebowski and how it captures L.A.? Is that an L.A. you recognize, or does it feel like a movie L.A.?
No, it's an L.A. movie, definitely. Especially the tumbleweed scene, going like the different parts of the streets of L.A. and ending at the beach. Yeah, that's very L.A. Starting at the desert to the city, and then boom, to the beach.
So I was going to say, there's little details like that that are probably done from a production standpoint, but ring true to L.A., like how most everything happens at night, because if you're going to do things in cars in L.A., at night is the only way to do them with any sort of speed. And I know they do that because that's probably the only way to make things happen on a set in L.A., to drive on the streets and, you know, over a highway to throw a briefcase. But it's also funny because in reality, that would be the only way to get things done that way in L.A., in a Los Angeles capacity.
The movie goes places like they go to Simi Valley to do the handoff. And for people who aren't in Los Angeles, like you were saying, Daniel, I mean, and again, I don't want my emotion to take over here. I want to let my some kind of empiricism and objectivity guide my conversation here. But I get frustrated when I see LA movies. And as you said, Daniel, it's just palm trees in Beverly Hills. And I'm like, guys, look, yeah, I've been to that street, you know, a few times. But that's not LA. And so that everybody thinks that it's the Hollywood sign in that street in Beverly Hills drives me nuts. So that they go to Simi Valley, which for people who aren't from Los Angeles, that's where the Reagan Library is. It's even outside the San Fernando Valley. Basically, all of the police officers and really conservative folks. This is not a totally fair thing about Simi Valley because it's as diverse as anywhere else. But a lot of people who don't like to, who just want to go to the most conservative part of LA, which is hard. There aren't that many places you can find like that. They go to Simi Valley, which is basically where they used to shoot Westerns. So it's just where there are a bunch of hills and rocks. And it's just funny that they name check that. You never see Simi Valley in an LA movie. And it's only like 20 miles from downtown. So Lebowski to me, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, is one of the few movies where I wouldn't touch a scene. Like Goodfellas, I wouldn't touch a line. I wouldn't touch a directorial choice. Every single scene is necessary. Every single line is amazing. Oddly, interestingly, and this happens a lot, the Coen brothers have gone on the record that they don't get it. They don't get why people love this movie. And Ethan Coen has even said it weirds him out a little bit when people come up to him and want to talk about that one. He's like, they don't even understand why that's the one they want to talk about. And Joel Coen has also said, like, they just have to be honest. They don't feel as passionately about Lebowski as other people do. But I think what's interesting is the cast does. John Goodman and Jeff Bridges have both gone on record that it's probably their favorite roles.
Wasn't it last year or something? John Goodman got a star on the Walk of Fame, and Jeff Bridges introduced him in character as the dude.
I think. Like, you could see that they bonded over the movie, and it's one of those things I think about where it's really important to remember. I think once you've made a movie, it's not yours anymore. It's the audience's, and I mean that in the best possible way. And whatever that alchemy is between movie and audience, if it's a hit, I really feel like you shouldn't touch it. You just need to leave it. And so it's like Star Wars or Raiders or whatever. The audience has bonded with it. So don't go back and re-edit it. Don't go back and redo stuff to it. Don't go back. This is my own opinion. Other people can take me to task on it. But I'm glad that the Coens don't do that to their movies. The only movie they did that on was Blood Simple, interestingly. But everything else, they've left alone.
That kind of leads to one of my favorite tidbits is the first time I ever saw this was on TV. And the TV version of the movie has become sort of infamous because of the way it shifts lines to make them TV appropriate, to a point that one of my favorite artists, Phoebe Bridgers, her debut album is called Stranger in the Alps, as a reference to, obviously on TV they can't have John Goodman screaming what he screams when he destroys the car. In the TV version he screams, this is what happens when you meet a stranger in the Alps.
When you find a stranger
in the Alps, yeah, because that's to match this word.
Alliteration.
And he just keeps screaming that and it doesn't make any sense, but it's beautiful. And it's almost worth, just go look up that scene. That's the best part on YouTube. And it's great to see how they make that happen.
So kind of off topic, my other favorite censor thing, you probably know this one, Daniel, but in Hot Fuzz, when he says, when he takes the Lord's name in vain, he goes, the censored airline version is peas and rice.
Talking about getting something different out of the movie, here we were at the drive-in and we're running around working. It's not like the Vista where we can just sit down and watch the movie. All of us are doing bathroom duty or run into the street to let late cars in. It's really a different kind of beast. But I was watching the movie as much as I could, and I can't believe I never put this together. But when he first goes to see Maud, which for people who have attended our movies at the Palace Theater, which is a movie palace in downtown Los Angeles, Maud's apartment is directly above it. And I've gotten to see it, and I've always wanted to have a party there. But when the dude gets called by Maud, she's doing an art piece because she's a conceptual feminist artist, but she's doing it nude, Jackson Pollock style, where she's on a harness. I never put together that from the very beginning Maud is testing him to see if he'll make a good prospective father because she wants to have a kid with him. So watching the movie, I realized every scene is Maud deciding if she wants to have sex with the dude. And so she intros to see if he's into her. Then the next time she gets him checked out. And the reason that Knox Harrington, the video artist played by David Thewlis, is laughing the whole time, he's doing it because he knows what Maud's doing, but Lebowski doesn't. So he's laughing because he's inside that Lebowski's going to be Maud's surrogate dad for her baby. He's going to be his baby daddy. And so anyway, like every time I see the movie, I'm like, they thought everything through. Every single thing.
This movie is also extremely funny. I don't know if we emphasize that enough. One of the funniest movies. I think it's their best comedy, probably, the Coen brothers. Sam Elliott's hilarious. in his little role. But I think the funniest, the joke that always cracks me up more than anything, is when he's with hanging out with Jackie Treehorn, and Jackie Treehorn writes something on that pad, and he leaves, and the dude does the, like, pencil cross-hatching thing to see what someone wrote on the pad. And apparently Jackie Treehorn just drew a picture of a man with a huge penis. And that's such a interesting, it's not just funny because it's random, it's funny because it is such a, like, inversion of, like, a detective movie idea or trope. Because it is, like, one of the few times the dude tries to do anything that would even put him in the same ballpark as, like, Philip Marlowe, who the character he sort of has replaced in this narrative, more or less. And even when he tries, the universe is like, no, like, here's a picture of a man with a giant penis.
But riffing with you on that, the funny thing about the movie is if you watch it, the dude actually solves the mystery.
He does by the end.
By the end. And so they do this weird thing. There's that, like, rule in screenwriting that if you're going to do a genre, try to invert everything or do it differently. And you feel like the Coens took that, which was, let's get the guy least equipped to solve a Raymond Chandler-esque mystery. But at the end, he's, like, drinking his White Russian, and he's just smoked, like, just blazed Major J. And he's like, oh, man, my thinking on this was all too uptight, man. And then he, like, figures it out. And so it's still, he still lands the plane.
The thing I was going to return back to is, I think in the Coen's filmography, Lebowski's such an interesting character because I think he's genuinely one of their most fully realized in an arsenal of incredible characters. And he's so easy to pinpoint as being a very basic sort of trope, but the way that he's written and the way that Bridges portrays him, he's, you know, he has every type of cliche associated with his sort of hippie mindset, but I don't know, his entire performance and the way he gets to behave and the way he evolves, or really doesn't evolve, because every time he starts to kind of find it, he sort of falls back to his old F it mantra, is, I think, really dope. I think he's like one of their primo creations.
You know, Will Durant, the historian, said that religions are born, not made, which I thought was a really, really, really percept, which I think is true. So, like, when you get Scientology, that's a little different because that one was made. I don't think the Coens intended, what I'm trying to get at is, I don't think the Coens intended for Big Lebowski to suddenly appeal to a lot of people who would look at the dude as a Zen master, but it's clearly written into that character that the dude abides, that the dude, like, transcends his tribalisms to be best friends with a Vietnam vet. And there's this humanism in the movie that, like, you get over your tribalisms. You know, the Jesus rolls with his probation officer. They're, like, on a bowling team. You'd start to notice that everybody who's friends in the movie, they get over whatever their thing is.
Even Philip Seymour Hoffman becomes kind of friendly towards him by the end, I feel like.
Yeah, you like Brandt.
He's hilarious in this, too. That's a connective tissue between the movies.
And my favorite part of the film is where he gets knocked out of Jackie Treehorn's place, and we get that cool little short film of a Lebowski just tripping out.
Gutter balls.
And you see Fidel Castro there giving him his bowling shoes.
Saddam Hussein.
Oh, Saddam Hussein. But that whole segment is just one of the most entertaining and well-thought shots in the whole movie. It's just hilarious, man. Especially the song he used.
We didn't even talk about this, but the Coens made one of the most fascinating decisions I've ever seen. The movie came out in 1998, but they set it in 1991. They said it just, which is a really weird thing. It's a period movie, but only by 7 years. And when I saw it for the first few times, I always was like, oh, that's funny that they said it during the Iraq War One. But they end the movie with a vet, by the way, which a lot of people forget. It's a vet bowling. And it just seems to be a quintessentially Coen's Midwestern statement about the understanding that, you know, who we are or how people see us is not completely and fully who we are. And it's just a very profound picture. I love Big Lebowski. It's my favorite Coen Brothers movie. It's one of my top 35 movies of all time. I watch it once or twice a year. For all the reasons everybody has said, it's a genre movie, a noir movie, an LA movie, and it's just its own thing. The two things I'll talk about, there are too many parts in the movie that I love, but one of my favorite LA moments for all of us who are here is when he goes to Malibu and then he gets to that cop. And that cop is just telling him to get out of Malibu. And he's like, get out of my beach community, Lebowski. And if you live in Los Angeles and you don't know how Malibu operates, Malibu is where a lot of rich people live when they don't want to deal with everybody else, because you can only get into it and out of it by PCH and two roads that cut across these canyons. And when you're in Malibu, you definitely feel like you are a visitor. You never feel like, hey, I can move here. You know, Johnny Carson, Barbara Streisand, James Cameron, Christopher Nolan, all those cats live in Malibu. And so just that's always a funny beat to me, because as a Los Angelino who has never lived anywhere near Malibu, I've been in the valley and the east side. I definitely sense that I'm always a visitor when I go there, and it's out of my price range. And then the other thing I just want to say is I was a tutor forever. And that's how I made my money. I tutored the SAT and the ACT, and we would occasionally get celebrities. You would tutor celebrities. And I tutored a few, but I won't go on to it on the show. But I had a friend who tutored Dr. Dre's kids. This is my favorite story. And I can't say where Dre lived or whatever, but when he went to Dr. Dre's house, Dr. Dre had a password that you had to tell the bodyguards at the gate. And if you didn't get the password right, you were not let into the house. And can anyone guess what Dr. Dre's password was about 15 years ago? Jackie Treehorn.
No.
And so Dre is a Lebowski lover too. And you had to go up to this like buff bodyguard at the gate and you had to be like, Jackie Treehorn. And then they'd be like, you can come in. And then he went and he tutored Dre's kids. So I have an LA story within an LA story. The second movie, the B movie we showed on this double feature, is sometimes an LA movie that people don't talk about as much as even some of his other LA movies, but Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love, which basically was Paul Thomas Anderson wanting to make an Adam Sandler movie. It's 90 minutes. It's a comedy. It stars Adam Sandler as Barry Egan, this very nervous, anxious owner of a bathroom novelties warehouse company in the San Fernando Valley. He's got seven sisters, and he's a very lonely, tightly wound dude. And then he makes both his greatest discovery and his greatest mistake on the same day. He meets Emily Watson, who he falls in love with. But then that night, before he realizes that he's going to go out on a date with Emily Watson, he calls some phone sex line. And basically, they want to scam him because he gives them all their credit card information. So he starts his first romance and suddenly gets involved in a blackmail scheme all in the same day. It's very much a screwball comedy. You know, Paul Thomas Anderson had said he had just made Magnolia, which was this 3+ hour or near 3 hour sort of sad magnum opus. And he just wanted to do something different. I often view, and I want you to take me to task for this. I often view Punch Drunk Love as the first Paul Thomas Anderson movie where he's really doing his own thing almost completely.
I admittedly haven't seen Magnolia or Hard Eight, but no one's seen that one. But I'll say this, I like Boogie Nights, but it definitely doesn't feel like a Paul Thomas Anderson film. It feels like him doing Scorsese.
It does. It's his Raging Bull. You literally see like, I'm going to do Raging Bull.
But Punch Drunk Love, despite how different it is from The Master and Will Be Blood, it still feels a piece.
Sang, I agree with you completely. I think Punch Drunk Love inaugurates Paul Thomas Anderson totally comfortable with what his voice would be. Because Magnolia is an Altman film. It's Nashville that takes place in Los Angeles. And Hard Eight is actually another kind of Altman feeling film, California Split, which was a gambler movie. But obviously Anderson's gone on record that he had a hell of a time making the movie he wanted to make. He never calls the movie Hard Eight. He always refers to the movie as Sydney to this day.
I like this movie a lot. This, I think for a while, was actually my favorite PTA movie. I recognize how great There Will Be Blood is and The Master, but I tend to like his more positive films, I suppose I would say, which this falls into it with. I think now, honestly, I think I like Phantom Thread more. I don't know. I will say watching it this time as someone who's been living in an apartment by himself for 6 months now, literally not seeing a single person, kind of bummed me out a little bit watching this movie about connection. In terms of it being LA, I had actually, before you announced it, for some reason in my head, I thought it took place in Florida. I don't know why. And then I was like, oh, I guess
because of the Hawaii bit.
I think because of the Hawaii bit is part of it. And because that's also like what the movie was sold on originally, like the poster is them in Hawaii.
Yeah.
This one's much, much more than Lebowski. It's a much more subtler LA film.
You know, I programmed it because I so identified it as a San Fernando Valley movie in a way that, because I'm from the Valley, so I recognize the Valley he was portraying. But it is a movie that like a large part of it takes place in Hawaii and he goes to Utah. So it's not solely in L.A. the way Lebowski is.
I always avoided this movie for some reason. until like somewhere in March or April, I decided to give it a watch, and like it was like the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. It's probably one of Paul Thomas Anderson's best films, and as for Adam Sandler as well. You know, after like a second viewing, there's something that caught my eye when Adam Sandler is in the 99 cent store looking at a pudding and stuff. You see this little red figure in the background, and it kept following him and following him and following him. And so I realized that's Emily Watson just following him in the 99 cent store. I never noticed that until I saw the movie for a second time. And that's a very cool eye. I never noticed that. That was kind of cool.
I've never noticed that. I'm going to have to rewatch the film. I got the Blu-ray now, so.
I wouldn't necessarily call it an L.A. movie because it's not necessarily in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles area. It's strictly a Valley movie. Because I don't know, I don't know some of the parts in the Valley. I just know a tiny bit, but it's like a straight up Valley movie, like San Fernando Valley, Tarzana, because that's where the 99 cent store is at.
Woodland Hills,
yes, Woodland Hills. But it's just a great film. The score is brilliant. I just love the score so much. It almost plays as a fantasy movie,
and it's almost a musical. I mean, that score. The way the movie plays is it's almost like a symphony because it moves musically. It doesn't move narratively.
It also makes it very stressful. It reminds me for a lot of reasons. It reminds me of Uncut Gems.
And it's funny because it's designed to be stressful. You're designed to sort of be Barry Egan for the majority of the picture.
I moved to LA in 2014. I've only lived in the Valley. So the little details about the Valley that are not overt, they're not so much story structured, but they're character structured, I think are effective because it's the weird, it's the pan out to the car and just the way that these like gigantic, like oversized streets without many cars on them, and the way the house is set up when he goes to his sister's house and the 99 cent store. Those are specific to that part of LA, and they do feel different than even Lebowski in that regard, because it's part of, as you talked about, the different cultural centers of LA make every little area feel like a completely different little world. And I think PTA really captures why the Valley, how the Valley feels in that regard. And it's not fair to categorize, like, Adam Sandler's amazing in this. People are always like, it's his best performance. But he's doing something completely different. And I think Anderson realized sort of what he has as a comedian that lets him work. Because this is still a comedy. It's just a different type of comedy. It's the screwball, like you said. And it does sort of radiate. It has Uncut Gems energy because combined with the music and multiple things. I always think of the scene where when she comes to visit him in his office to ask if he wants to have lunch. And he's answering the phone and he's touching the piano, and there's the accident with the forklift happening in the backyard. It's just that chaos, and you've been there. It's weird because it feels, you know, heightened for dramatic purposes, but it also feels like you've been in those moments and you feel his anxiety, because I think his social anxiety is important to him as a character. And sometimes movies, when they choose to focus on someone with that type of social anxiety, I view them through a different glass, because they sometimes use that as like in a way that I think where they don't understand how that anxiety affects an actual person.
Right.
And I think this really nails it, of sort of how your mind works. And he imposes that on every part of the filmmaking, with the camera work, with the music, that makes you share in that. And I think that's is why, to me, it's so effective. So good. And it's another one of those that every time I revisit it, I think it rises a little bit in my ranking of his films.
I agree. It is. And it's funny that both Lebowski and Punch Drunk, I feel, have gotten more appreciated over time. And I don't know what that says about a certain kind of movie. I always think about that, which is, you know, God willing, I get to make movies. You never know if you've made a good movie or not for like 5 to 10 years, because you could make a movie that everybody's going to love that year and no one talks about 4 years later. Or you could make a movie that that dies, and then suddenly 7 years later, everyone's talking to you about it.
Theorizing briefly, when you look at the movies that are around those movies for those filmmakers, Magnolia and There Will Be Blood, and then Fargo, and what did they make after?
I think The Man Who Wasn't There. Or maybe Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
They got all... Well, then that kind of screws this up. But they're making these filmmakers who have kind of become known maybe for more serious things, or at least maybe not known, have been recently appreciated for that. And I think in general...
Oh, that's a great observation.
I mean, people don't take comedy stuff. They don't necessarily take genre stuff as seriously. Just in general, that they don't. Recently, they have, you know, especially if you look at the Oscars. But I think maybe that's a big part of it, is that these movies come out and they feel like, oh, they're light. They're like, you know, whatever.
They're goofing off.
They're goofing off. And then I think it takes like several years to realize, oh, okay, no, actually, you know, they're doing something pretty deep here.
I love Punch Drunk Love. And what I specifically love about it is that it's about a character who is very nervous. He's an adult man, so obviously his behaviors are ingrained. It's not like he can easily change them. He's already in his 30s at some point. But over the course of the movie, both because he's forced to and because he wants to, he actually deals with some of his character flaws. And you see somebody go from anxiety and cowardice to being able to assert themselves. And it's done in a way that, weirdly, as much as the movie is a screwball comedy and it's not like real life or whatever, it feels, I buy it. I buy his change. I buy that he's like, wait, I finally have a girlfriend. Like, I finally have someone I really care about, and I'm not going to F this up.
That line at the end with Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's obviously, like, very romantically written, but the line about, I have so much strength in me because I have love in my life. It's such a sweet, genuine line also.
A wonderful line. Like everyone was saying, I guess just in terms of why I programmed it as an LA movie, I was born in the Valley and we lived in the Valley for a number of years when Marta was going to Cal State Northridge. And I have very ambivalent feelings about the Valley because my folks divorced when I was six there. So when I go back to the Valley, I often feel like I'm going to the sort of like returning to my subconscious. And so it's a very ambivalent feeling. But like they have this, Daniel, you were talking about it, when they're on Van Nuys Boulevard with all the car dealerships. If you're from the Valley, you know where they are immediately. You're like, oh, they're on Van Nuys Boulevard. And they go to that restaurant, you know, they're both in the restaurant and they walk out. And there are all these restaurants in the Valley that are like, that were established in the 60s and 70s that are dark wood and red for some reason. I don't know why those were the predominant colors, but, and so they're in one of those dark wood and red restaurants. And it's probably just Paul Thomas Anderson doing what he knew and not even thinking about it as an LA movie, but it or like the other thing I loved, I don't know if you guys, is Barry Egan's apartment has no wall dressing. And if you've ever been in the apartments of people just out of college with no money, you often walk into an apartment and it has the slat blinds and there's no money for wall dressing whatsoever. And that's a comment on him too, but that was just like a little detail. I was like, oh, that's incredible.
We should also probably discuss the connective tissue, as you mentioned, and Connor mentioned before, about Philip Seymour Hoffman between the two of these, which was accidental.
Yeah, and so weirdly, when we program this, he's in both Lebowski and Punch Drunk Love.
On completely different ends of what he's doing too.
I think my favorite line delivery of any Philip Seymour Hoffman performance is in this movie is his shut up is incredible.
Mine would go to after Sandler confronts him at the mattress store and does the that's that part, and Sandler's leaving the building and he comes back out to get the last word in and he's like, you know, get out of here, you pervert. And Sandler spins around and he's like, I told you. He goes, that's that. And then just walks off the screen. And that's the last time you see him. And it's so incredible.
You know, I had Daniel, I'm glad you made sure we did this. I had a Philip Seymour Hoffman dream last night. And I don't often dream of celebrities. Usually it's directors, very rarely actors. But I had this dream that Philip Seymour Hoffman was walking down this dark street. It was night. And I ran up to him and I had my son in my arms. And my son is also named Craig. Yes, I love that we share a name, but he's really named after my dad, who is also Craig. And my dad died when I was 23. So, and I love my father with all my heart. So I named my son after my dad. We all happen to be Craig. So I had Craigie in my arms and I ran up to Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it was a weird dream because I had known in the dream that he was eventually going to die of substance abuse and falling off the wagon. And it was almost as if we were in another world or the afterworld or something. But I ran up to him, but it was also like he was alive and we had time traveled. And I ran up to him with Craigie in my arms and I said, Craigie, say hi to Uncle Phil. And he said, hi, Uncle Phil. And then Philip Seymour Hoffman smiled and I looked at him and it was like I was trying to tell him he didn't have to fall off the wagon, or like I wanted him to know there were other things and I wanted him to stick around. And then there was this dark-haired guy standing next to him who I could tell was one of those enablers. Like this was the guy that was going to get him to do whatever, the heroin or the drinking. And he and I had real bad energy and I looked at him and Philip Seymour Hoffman walked down into the shadows with this guy with dark hair and I held Craigie in my arms and I was like in the dream, God, I hope that worked. And then I woke up. So that was my dream. from last night. And but it was very, it was, sometimes I have dreams that I know are the toilet bowl of my mind. And I know that I was dealing with, I'd seen Philip Seymour Hoffman, and clearly I think about him a lot because I think he's such a genius actor. But it was also a dream where it felt more than dream. I don't want to get into that because I know we all have different philosophies.
Do you wonder, you just brought up your dad, and I wonder, I don't want to psychoanalyze you, but your dad had substance abuse issues, right?
He did. Oh,
and
yeah, totally.
You think you, maybe your subconscious was connecting him to Philip Seymour Hoffman?
You know what? It's so funny. I think you may be absolutely right. My dad was a drinker, and my dad did have other substance abuse issues. He eventually died of cancer, not of substance abuse.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, my dad also left when I was 23, and I always felt he left too soon, and I wish he had stuck around because I wanted him to see his grandkids. And he was a brilliant man, my dad. Obviously, I'm biased, but he was. And I think connecting him to Philip Seymour Hoffman and that personality type is would be an easy thing to do in my subconscious. They were, in some ways, self-destructive, brilliant men. So there you go.
Whoa, breakthrough.
Yeah,
wow. I did it.
Call me Dr. Cruz.
So now, just real quickly before we go to pop culture and final thought, maybe if you guys can always blow it up and just do whatever you want, but maybe name another L.A. movie that you think has a great sense of L.A. place that you love.
I got three for L.A., all of which I featured in the pre-show that we didn't show. But unfortunately, two of them, The Long Goodbye and Inherent Vice, I think would make a really solid triple feature with The Big Lebowski.
Totally.
Because they're all these sort of off-center LA comedy noir films. And I don't have much to say about them in terms of their LA-ness.
And they're all kind of slacker detective
movies. Yeah, they're all like slacker detective movies. And even beyond that, you know, I would say that there's connections between, I mean, the dude is a pretty, in some ways you could almost do like a graph with the dude on one side and Elliot Gould's Philip Marlowe, and Joaquin Phoenix is in the middle of those two characters, essentially. Probably my favorite LA movie is Mulholland Drive, which is specifically a Hollywood movie, we should say, and not an LA as a whole movie, and is obviously doing a heightened version of LA. But
yeah, but that's such an LA movie. I mean, that gets a dark LA.
Yeah, well, I think that's what literally Lynch described it as, is a poisonous love letter to Los Angeles. You guys have driven up there, right? I went there once just to drive it. And yeah, Mulholland Drive is this winding road up in the mountains that separates Los Angeles from the valley. It's a scary drive to a certain degree, and it's a weirdly isolated place.
It's very quiet.
There's a lot of interesting touches about that movie. I love that weird like ranch place he goes up to into the hills to meet the cowboy. Feels like very specific. Like I've driven up in that area, you know, and driven to places like that. And the diner too reminds me so much of, I know it's like,
oh, the Denny's.
Yeah, it's supposed to be kind of a Denny's, but there's something specific about it that feels like a diner in Los Angeles.
Well, the thing that weirds me out is I know the Denny's he's doing.
Oh yeah,
that's the weirdest part about how specific that is. It's the Denny's on Sunset Boulevard, right where the 101 is, right around Vine.
Wait, you telling me that Denny is on Sunset?
Dude, just go on Sunset Boulevard. Go to where Sunset Boulevard crosses the 101. I know where it
is. Look around back and you'll find...
Yeah, go around back and meet the weird dude behind the dumpster. Yeah.
He's going to give you the blue box.
That's that Denny's? Holy shit, I've gone to that Denny's so many times. What the fuck?
That's that Denny's, homie. Edwin or Daniel?
I have to watch that movie again. I have so many. I have a list of like favorite Los Angeles movie, but I'm going to pick one, and Volcano. Volcano. Yes, that's right. I'm going with Volcano. I was going to go with Falling Down, but I had to give love to favorite disaster movie.
Do it. Give it love. This is what makes this podcast work. Shout out Volcano, a movie I have not thought about since it opened.
Volcano is a great, great movie of the 90s. It's Tommy Lee Jones.
I've never even heard of this
movie. It's one of my favorite movies. It's Tommy Lee Jones being the same character he's been in The Fugitive. A volcano erupts out of the La Brea tar pit and starts spilling all over the street down on, is it Wilshire?
Yeah.
It's a great alias movie because it gets all the places, including MacArthur Park. Which not a lot of movies get shot there. Not a lot. Only a few. But I'm about to go to MacArthur Park in a little bit to get a new phone. And so I'll be like, hey, that's where they shot Volcano. That's where Tommy Lee Jones was, man. That's so cool. It's a great LA's movie because they talk about all the street that's happening, you know. Like, it's going to hit La Cienega. Like, of course, I know where La Cienega is, you know. Those lava spilling over the streets of Los Angeles. They had to blow up a building to divert the lava to the ocean. And then, you know, and then...
This is, I'll say this, Edwin. This is on my radar big time now. This looks like exactly the kind of, and I mean this in the most loving way possible, schlock that I am into.
This was one of those weird instances, Connor, where they came out, their two volcano movies came out the same week.
Dante's Peak.
They were like, the studios were rushing. Dante's Peak and Volcano. Somehow the studios were like, America wants to see a volcano disaster movie.
Volcano time, baby.
I like how the movie ends with the Randy Newman song. I love LA. That is just perfect.
I'll just say this. You'll probably cut this, but just to, I knew that this movie existed. I didn't know it was an LA movie. I knew that there was like a movie that came out at the same time as Dante's Peak that was also a volcano movie that was just called Volcano, but I had no idea it was like, I had no idea what the premise was.
Connor, directed by the guy who directed LA Story. The Steve Martin comedy L.A. Story.
Wow. And The Bodyguard, right?
Oh, my God. Why did I say that movie instead? Because that's a hardcore L.A. movie as well.
The Bodyguard?
No, L.A. Story.
But Volcano was better. Volcano, like, woke us all up.
No, Volcano, man. Volcano's a f***ing badass movie, man.
I thought it was just like Dante's Peak is just kind of a regular...
Oh, hell no. Screw Dante's Peak.
But you know what I mean? It's like, it's a more, yeah. it's a more standard volcano movie.
Oh yeah. No, Volcano went full ridiculous.
Yeah.
Volcano is like people running on Wilshire Boulevard past LACMA.
That's what I'm saying. That's why I'm like, I got my eye on you.
My LA selection is a recent movie, Booksmart, the Olivia Wilde directed Booksmart. It takes place almost entirely in the San Fernando Valley. I can't pretend that I know what high school's like anymore, having been 10 plus years removed now. But it feels the way that I felt in high school with my friends as that was coming to an end in a way that rarely... I think Superbad captured that, and I think going through some of the coming-of-age stuff we've done is a hard thing to do, and I think Booksmart deserves more recognition for nailing that feeling of the people that you're closest to and the decision of who you're going to be because it might pull you apart. And the way it uses LA through places like Lido's Pizza and, you know, jokes about Ubers and the placement of things and how long it would take to get to places and blah, blah, blah. I think Booksmart is a great LA movie and just a great, I think, a very underrated coming of age comedy. And as Connor mentioned, I think it's one of those that 10 years from now, we will talk about how it was underappreciated and is now regarded as the classic it deserves to be. And also going off, I completely didn't even think about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I think you could take a lot of Shane Black's written filmography, but in terms of his directorial filmography, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Iron Man 3, and The Nice Guys, even though it was shot in Atlanta, is still about L.A., and they all feel, they use very specific L.A. things in the core of their story that I think are incredibly effective, whether it's, you know, Tony Stark's house in Malibu, or Kiss Kiss Bang Bang's sort of very, like, almost nihilistic view of Hollywood and fame, and then The Nice Guys, similar take on that, actually. I think Shane Black maybe has some issues with Hollywood, which makes sense. But I think all three are really great, and The Nice Guys is one of those that every time I come back, I think it's twice as good as I did the time before. So
There are so many L.A. movies that I would want to talk about. I'm only going to really talk about one. You know, I love Altman's three L.A. movies, actually. If you wanted to do an Altman L.A. trilogy, Long Goodbye, as Connor's already said, is incredible. Probably my favorite of the Altmans. But then The Player is equally, actually, an L.A. movie. But it really, you know, again, is really specifically, actually, if you've ever been on a studio a lot, and that's something that's very unique to people in the movie industry, unless you see a movie about it. But they nail what movie studio lots used to feel like. I don't know that they quite feel this way anymore because of what's happened, but Player's great. And then, of course, Shortcuts, where Robert Altman took all these Raymond Carver short stories, which actually took place in the Northwest, oddly, in like Washington, and he set them in L.A., but there's like a Hollywood Hills story and a Downey story and even though Shortcuts is not my favorite, it's still a movie that again, doesn't make fun of L.A., somehow captures something about L.A., and you know, you could almost do that fun thing where they're like Blade Runner is an L.A. movie, but it's sort of an imagined L.A. movie of the future.
I mean, they got the Bradbury Building.
Totally. Yeah. It's still like it's sort of what downtown might be.
And Union Station.
Yeah. So there's a great documentary, actually, I recommend if anybody can get their hands on it. It's never, I think, been given a commercial release because of copyright issues. But it's Tom Anderson's Los Angeles Plays Itself. which is incredible and is one of my favorite comfort food documentaries. It is 3 hours of every single great movie made in LA, and he divides it into how they do them, and it's great. Like, one of the things that you see in a lot of LA movies that you would never know where it is the St. Thomas Vincent Bridge, or the St. Vincent Thomas Bridge, which is in the port of LA. But if you see a Michael Mann movie or you see a Tony Scott movie, and unfortunately Mr. Scott committed suicide off that bridge, it's the bridge that basically goes into the port of Los Angeles, and it feels like science fiction. It feels weird. Marta and I went over it recently. You almost feel like you're in a dream. But anyway, Los Angeles Plays itself is amazing. It also talks about the indie movies that were made in LA, like Killer of Sheep, The Exiles, just like all this To Sleep With Anger, but or A Woman Under the Influence. I mean, John Cassavetes' Faces, those are LA movies. But the one I'm going to shout out, and I'm going to go quickly, is, and I've said this before, and I want to say this in the right way, I am a great admirer of Quentin Tarantino. I think he is a great director. I think that he is keeping the auteur flame alive. Every time I see one of his movies, I think he is burning with talent and making great movies. I loved Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, one of my favorites, but I want to talk about Jackie Brown. I just want to say that of all of Quentin Tarantino's movies, possibly the one I love the most is Jackie Brown, because it takes place in an LA I fully recognize, and an LA that he doesn't film up. It's not about, even though I know he's talking about blaxploitation movies and Jack Hill movies and this and that, the South Bay, because it takes place where he was born, I know that. I know that Tarzana. I know that Del Alma Mall. I know where those people are. I know where they live. I know the LAX that he shows. And I love Jackie Brown. I know that Chris Tucker apartment that Sam Jackson goes to get Chris Tucker. And if you want to just see what I feel is maybe Quentin Tarantino's most naturalistic, beautiful film, I highly recommend. And the movie that I relate to the most in his entire filmography, it is Jackie Brown. I love Jackie Brown. I just want to shout out Jackie Brown.
I would also, my favorite Friedkin movies are To Live and Die in L.A. and The Sorcerer, which is not in L.A. And I'm surprised no one talked about L.A. Confidential. That film is an L.A. movie.
Oh, you could go, but that's the point. We could go on and on. Like, we could go down. No one talked about Rebel Without a Cause. If somebody wanted to pull out, like, one of the weird great L.A. movies is the James Dean film, which ends at the Griffith Park Observatory. And there's a drag race on the Palisades and the Pacific Palisades. And there's a great sense of L.A. in that. And Big Sleep, Howard Hawks' is the Big Sleep. Great Noir, DOA. I mean, we could be here all night.
Freddie Got Fingered.
Freddy Got Finger, which I haven't seen.
Don't watch it.
Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker.
Oh.
LA movie.
How could we forget that?
Clifford, the Martin Short movie. Yeah. Clifford, the Martin Short, Charles Grodin classic.
Where he plays a little boy.
Yeah, that's an LA movie. It's set in LA.
Oh, Clifford.
I was going to say, we could be here. We could just name every movie that takes place in LA. Spanglish. I mean, we could be here for a while.
Culture.
And final thoughts.
There's the intro to this.
Yeah. Pop culture, final thoughts with the boys.
I'm gonna isolate that and use that for every episode.
If you need it, let me know. I'll give you a really clean version. I started, there's a documentary on HBO called I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is about the Golden State Killer, but also about the writer Michelle McNamara, who was a true crime writer who was she coined the term Golden State Killer and was this journalist obsessed with not only finding out the truth, but also to give a story to the victims versus this, you know, we have this obsession as a culture with true crime and serial killers. And she talks about why we feel that at our core, but also like why it's important to humanize the victims beyond just this traumatic thing that happened to them. And the documentary follows both her process through writing the book until her untimely death before it was completed and what happened to complete the book, but also about interviews the victims and talks about her life and how this obsession into this darkness cost her a lot of, it hurt her mentally as well. And it's a lot about the mental health of that. And it's very powerful. It's also very hard to watch because there's a lot of, not so much graphic, but in terms of what people discuss in terms of what the Golden State Killer did, and also there's some, you know, audio tapes that play, and it's very unsettling and maybe not the best thing to watch in the pandemic, but it's also very powerful.
She solved it, right?
She was not unfortunately passed before it was, but since then her research and renewed interest in it because of her writing led to the eventual capture of him, partially because of her push for using DNA services that were capturing to try and find relatives, which let the investigators that kind of reopened things track down the killer through DNA samples that were taken that they had from the scene of him, but also with his relatives. It's pretty wild.
You know, I just been rocking, you know, stalking. My Warzone just finished updating out for 2 days because it has a 63 gigabyte thing. And the past the time, I did a little creature feature. I did 3 creature movies. I did Deep Star 6, The Relic, which is probably one of my personal favorites, and The Ghost in the Darkness with Kilmer and Douglas. So that was fun, seeing them go against up lions. That's awesome. And as you can see, I got Natural Born Killers and I got Taxi Driver up. So that's cool.
That's right. For our audience who can't see, we always get to see Edwin in his room with this wide-angle PlayStation lens he's got or whatever. Is it Xbox or PlayStation?
It's Xbox. The Xbox Kinect, man. Get the facts straight, bro.
I think I've mentioned this before, but I'm rereading Shakespeare. And it's interesting. About maybe 10, 15 years ago, I read all the works of Shakespeare. And I'd never read them all, you know, except the ones I'd read in high school or whatever. And that time, I just was, oh my goodness, there are all these plays that no one talks about that are as good as the ones we do, like Coriolanus, which is this incredible observation on how the messiness of democracy, even though it's a real problematic play, Measure for Measure, gets into the hypocrisy of a puritanical attitude in law. It's really fascinating. But this time I'm reading it for structure, because I've always felt that one of my big weaknesses as a writer is an understanding of structure. Shakespeare writes in a 5-act structure, which filmmakers abbreviated to 3 acts. But I prefer actually thinking about things in 5 acts. And I do have to say that I've just read the Scottish play, which anybody who knows, you never call it by its name because of superstition, and I'm riven by superstition, so I'll just refer to it as the Scottish play. And then you can do it, Connor, if you're not riven by superstition.
McDonald's.
Yeah, see, baby? So the Scottish play, I read Midsummer Night's Dream, and I'm just finishing up Comedy of Errors, which is hilarious. By the way, let's see if Edwin can get it. Edwin.
Yeah.
Comedy of Errors was made as what 80s comedy starring Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler?
I know it's Touchstone Pictures.
Yep.
I know they're siblings.
They're twins separated at birth.
Their work at a hotel. I have that movie. Hold on a second.
Big,
I have it here.
Big is the first word.
No, shut up. Shut the hell up. Shut up. Big Business 1988. Touchstone Pictures. Yeah.
Rest in peace, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Wow.
Can't beat me.
Okay.
Can't beat me.
Just went Super Saiyan.
So, Comedy of Errors was made as Big Business, but the 5-act structure, it's great. So anyway, does anyone want to do the outro today while I play harmonica?
I'll do some Bob Dylan. I could do some Bob Dylan.
I'll do the outro. I forget all the things you say.
Just do it. Whatever you want to say, buddy. Here we go. Go for it.
So you got to go to secretmovieclub.com. You can find other podcasts and stuff. We got Radio Hour coming up. We got movies this weekend, tonight when this releases, Shaun of the Dead and Dawn of the Dead double feature, and Toy Story on Sunday. You can search Secret Movie Club Eventbrite, find our Eventbrite page. We're Secret Movie Club 35mm on Facebook. We're going to be next week, we'll talk about zombie movies, and, you know.
Comes the time when I may. And I keep going.
All right, guys. Okay. Here we go. I'll play it out. Someone say goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you so much, everyone. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Let the music fade out.
Can't take down my Neil Diamond, baby.
No, Heather and I used to perform that every night on vinyl.
Love on the rocks, ain't no surprise.
Pour me a drink, and I'll tell you some lies.